then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's September the 25th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, getting underway here. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that there would be no more episodes of Who Guards the Guardians on here for a while, due to the murder in prison of Edgar Steele, which reminds us that federal law enforcement isn't funny. They're cowardly murderers who poison 69-year-old men in wheelchairs, and we just got a reminder of how unfunny they are. But you'll recall that the last Quis Custodiat Ipsos Custodis segment I did was on the Secret Service, and now they're back in the news again. On the night of September 12th, an insane Puerto Rican jumped over the White House fence, ran across the lawn, apparently opened the front door under the portico, and ran right into the White House. Accounts differ as to whether or not this crazed beaner was waving a butcher knife in the air. Some say he was, some say he wasn't. In any case, apparently this brown bozo almost made it into the actual residence in the East Wing before he was tackled and brought down. Not by the mighty Secret Service itself, but by the uniformed officers of the Federal Protective Service, who are the cops in the white shirts that you see in the background at White House ceremonies and who provide the security for most government buildings. The Secret Service did issue a statement, however, stating that after a thorough review of their security protocols, they're going to begin locking the front door, like God knows how many millions of other Americans have to who live in black or racially mixed neighborhoods. What can I tell you, people? These goons that the regime sends after us, they're just not that good at what they do. They're not real cops. Without electronic spying or an informer, they're pretty much useless. This Puerto Rican caught them completely by surprise, just like John Hinckley caught them by surprise back in 1981, because he was just one man. He did what he felt he had to do on his own. He didn't chatter on the internet, and he didn't tell everybody and his dog what he was going to do on his Facebook page. He just went out and did it. Now, fortunately for Barry Satoro, the beaner wasn't a real assassin, but suppose he had been. History might have been changed because Barry's bodyguards were too dumb to lock the front door. Okay, moving right along here. We have a new young comrade in California named Eli who tells me he's 13 years old. And several weeks ago, he emailed me a question which, for one reason or another, I haven't gotten around to answering yet, what with all the murder and the other sound and fury going on. Hey, HAC, I was wondering what your thoughts are on esoteric Hitlerism. I recently discovered it, and I find it very intriguing, to say the least. Do you believe that Aryan blood did not originate on Earth? It would explain a lot, eh? Signed, Eli. Okay, that's two-parter for Grandpa Simpson. First off, yes, there is an element in the World National Socialist Movement that has always wanted to transform National Socialism into a religion, including some elements in the Third Reich itself, with the figure of the Führer Adolf Hitler fulfilling the role of God or prophet. Now, probably the most noteworthy individual in this movement, the woman who more or less began it in modern times, was Savitri Devi, through her books Lightning in the Sun and Gold in the Furnace. Now, if you look around, Eli, you'll probably be able to find those books online somewhere or download them in PDF format. Now, I'm not sure how much of this movement of what you call esoteric Hitlerism or National Socialism is motivated by genuine religious or spiritual belief, and how much of it is just one of the many excuses that we all use to hide behind. An excuse to keep on whispering only among ourselves and never drawing attention to ourselves by standing up and speaking face to face with the Muggles about our beliefs and maybe making them mad and causing them to shout at us and point fingers at us and call us names and hurt our feelings and people maybe finding out about us and hurting us in our wallets and taking our stuff, our precious stuff. Now, there's a natural and understandable human tendency of older people in the movement, like my generation, and by now the generation following mine, people who have been in this thing of ours for a long time and seen nothing, and who have seen nothing but spinning wheels. Well, there's a tendency for guys like us to become depressed and disillusioned, and as they grow older, retreat into mysticism, because the people who become involved with us in the real world and in whom we have been compelled to place our trust are, by and large, so bitterly disappointing. Now, I understand this tendency, I just don't agree with it. I recognize it when it pops up in myself, or at least I hope I do, and I do my best to avoid it. Now, that's why I usually avoid mystical and spiritual discussion of all kinds on this show, and not just because that kind of discussion tends to shed heat rather than light. I'm always conscious of the danger of getting sidetracked from attempts to bring about actual change in the world, however futile those attempts may seem at times, by giving in to the lure of nice, safe, sometimes nutty mysticism. Yes, okay, I know I've slipped a couple of times in the past with some of my reincarnational comments. Now, if you really are interested, Eli or anybody else, in my mystical and spiritual views on things, then you need to order my novel from 2001, The Stars in Their Path. Now, it's true that I also broke character with the aliens thing a few weeks ago when I allowed Lord Lucan to mention alien conspiracy theory on this show, because whether I like it or not, there are now enough people around in our tiny little movement who believe in aliens of a conspiratorial kind, and so I figured it at least rated a passing mention. Now, in point of fact, and for the record, I believe in aliens myself, in the sense that the idea that we're completely alone in this huge universe is ridiculous. Now, whether extraterrestrials are in fact hiding among us already in caves or in government installations, and whether or not they're in contact with the government and manipulating world affairs, now that's another matter. I've noticed that idea floating around a lot more in recent years than it used to. I think it's part of our desperate need to explain what the hell is going on in our world as we watch it all fall apart with no apparent reason. It's also inexplicable. We need some kind of explanation that makes some kind of sense as to why these horrible things keep happening, other than the obvious explanation that our problems are caused by wicked human beings who are doing this because they can, and by stupid and incompetent human beings who are just going with the flow for money. Now, we don't want to face up to that unpleasant reality, because then that obligates us to do something about it, and that bothers us. It makes us feel bad about ourselves because we're too weak and timid and frightened to actually do what has to be done. Now, everybody knows what we have to do. These wicked and stupid and incompetent people who are ruling us need to be removed. And that terrifies us, because it means that we ourselves might actually be morally obligated to physically do something real, like moving to the Northwest homeland, for starters. One of these days, we may have to talk about David Icke and Bill White's books about the lizard people and the serpent gods, because these ideas are actually getting pretty popular as white people become ever weirder and more dysfunctional and frightened, and our people flee from real politics ever more. Now, David Icke can sell thousands of books and get millions of hits on his website talking about lizard people. We're still stuck at 5,000 hits a week on northwestfront.org talking about a country of our own as a racial homeland. Go figure. Also, apparently someone is so worried about Bill White's serpent gods theory that they've fabricated federal cases against him in order to make sure that he dies in prison. So something must be going on there, and again, for the record, I think it is very likely that the Jews are some kind of alternate order of human creation stemming from a different creator than the rest of us. Now, I don't know about the serpent business, but I have to admit that Jews as a whole are pretty reptilian. Hey, maybe Bill's on to something. I think this is kind of a natural thing among elderly people who have been more or less crushed by the world to spend their last years putting their hope in some kind of divine justice, that someday the spirit of the Fuhrer will just ascend from Valhalla with Viking warriors and the Leibstandart behind him and smite the wicked, or Jesus will come down and split the sky open, or the aliens from Omicron City who will bring the mothership down from the skies and take us all away, or something like that. But Eli, you tell me you're 13, I guess by now you're 14. Look, you're too young to be crushed by the world like that. You still need to hang on to your youthful enthusiasm and idealism and your youthful belief that the world can be changed, because it can be changed if kids like you will do what we were too weak and timid and frightened to do. Now, probably the most prominent case of what you call esoteric Hitlerism, Eli, would be a certain individual I'm thinking of who once called himself commander of the American Nazi Party, who spent years quietly liquidating all the old party's assets, the patrimony of 20 years of blood, sweat, and tears, including the blood of Commander Rockwell. And then he used the cash sum he accumulated to buy himself a retirement estate in Wisconsin. And there he still sits, sending out occasional bulletins worshipping the number 8. He retreated into mysticism that apparently demanded of him that he get rid of all public displays of the swastika and all outward signs of National Socialism. Those are now secret doctrines, the kind of thing we only whisper about among ourselves and never let anybody else see. Might make them mad. Anyway, this old duffer finally yielded to the 21st century enough to get a website, and if you will contact me privately, I'll send you the link so you can learn all you want about esoteric Hitlerism. Now, as much as I despise what this man did, I have to admit he knows his Adolf Hitler backward and forward better than any of us. Okay, now I understand that we need to remain functional in society, and we need to avoid what the liberals call economic discipline. Fair enough. And Americans particularly are terrified of being marked as different and cast out of the herd. We do no one any good if we're defunctionalized in society. I can also understand why some people's conversion to National Socialism is almost cult-like. It kind of was with me at age 18. There's probably some of both motivations in the esoteric Hitler thing. It's just that we must never attempt to replace the real-world efforts that we engage in, however pointless they may seem, to bring about change. We can't ever replace that with mystic resignation, which involves sitting down and waiting for some kind of divinely inspired outside deus ex machina. The world doesn't work like that. And if you want to worship Hitler or Odin or Yahweh, fine. But make sure it's on your own time and you're not on the clock, so to speak. The gods help those who help themselves.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss A Troublesome Inheritance by Nicholas Wade. This is a book that deals with the question of why there is such differences in various societies around the world in terms of overall productivity and progress. This is a book that is attempting to deal with the issue of evolution and its effect on behavior. The whole thesis of this book is about selection being recent, copious, and regional, and how there have been a lot of selective pressures, particularly in Eurasia. Now, one of the things that is often said about racial differences is that there are a lot of differences between individuals within groups, and some even say that differences between individuals within groups are greater than differences between groups. Now, in terms of common sense, this sounds rather odd, and in fact, the book explains that while there are differences within groups, the differences between groups are actually collated, and that magnifies them. If you read this book, it'll go into some technicalities about genetics. It'll also go into this history of eugenics and how various scientists have been understood or perhaps misunderstood over time due to various interpretations, and why the subject of eugenics is often unpopular and there's been a lot of propaganda against the subject of eugenics. Now, this is a mainstream book, but even so, it gives a very balanced view of things. It talks about one of these early scientists by the name of Morton and how he's often criticized for his skull measurements, which actually were correct. There's a lot of odd stories about these measurements in The Mismeasure of Man by Stephen Jay Gould, and much is made of how he was measuring skulls, and talks about how Morton's aims were mischaracterized in some literature. Also, how there's a difference between Darwin and Spencer, because even though Spencer believed in social Darwinism, Charles Darwin himself always urged mercy for the weak. And it talks about the clash between Boaz and Grant. But really, the main theme is social development. And it talks about how some societies developed agriculture. And the idea that this author has is that the development of agriculture led to a certain selection for what the author is talking about as tameness. In humans, this manifests behaviorally as being less violent, having a tendency towards thrift, and a greater level of trust for people that are not directly related to you. This issue of tameness was recently illustrated by a Russian scientist that did an experiment with foxes and selected simply for less aggression within foxes. So the thesis of this book is that a small behavioral change that doesn't necessarily have to affect everyone in society, but can become a general trend in society, can actually change the evolution of societies. The author talks about societies that have been very successful, talks about how Chinese and Asian societies became very successful. But very often what we have in China, and I suppose in Asia generally, or at least the more advanced Asian societies, is that we have a very high degree of conformity. Now, the author explains this by talking about the geography of China. Although I suppose you could also apply this to Japanese society, which the author does not mention. And how Chinese society developed to select for high intelligence, but a lack of original thought. Now, in the West, the author says that geography of the West prevented collectivism. I suppose this is true. I suppose it is also true that in the West we have much more variation within, for example, you might say nationalities or subraces than you do in China, where there's extreme similarity between individuals. And in some respects, it's hard to even tell Chinese people apart sometimes if they're the same age, the same gender. They're so much alike. Now, it also says, of course, that the Middle East originally was an area that did develop farming, and they made some progress for a time, but by the 10th century, they become so immersed in Islam that they really kind of stop there. It also talks about selection among Jews, particularly Ashkenazi Jews, and how they really put so much emphasis on scholarship, bookkeeping, and money lending that today, if you give most Ashkenazi Jewish people, for example, an IQ test, they will test high in verbal and math skills, but they will have a lower visuospatial IQ. Now, one of the key examples in this book is about England. Of course, England developed agriculture, but when you have agriculture, you're in a Malthusian trap because as you produce more food, your population goes up and then there are more that have to be fed. But it says that the Industrial Revolution, when it came to England and potentially other places, that actually sped up this selection for thrift, for less violence and more cooperation. The author doesn't mean to say that this only would happen among English people, but it's a good example because the author says that England has had good continuity of society over time and therefore can be studied. Now, the author does talk about another theory that has been promoted in a book called Guns, Germs, and Steel, about the success of the West and how that might be due simply to geography, which allowed for farming and other things later on. But the author asks why various immigrant groups, such as Asians or whites, can go to different places in the world and still fare very well. The author believes that there is some subtle genetic reason as to why there are these differences. And the author also points out that there is one very unique thing about the English, and also to a certain degree about people in the Indian subcontinent. And this is a notion of the rule of law, and the law being greater than, for example, a king or a ruler of some sort. And also gives examples of things like how genes will drive culture, and gives the example of lactose tolerance. It talks about language mosaic zones, where you have many different languages and language spread zones, which is what Europe is. Now, this author is very optimistic about the West. As I said, this is a mainstream author, and this author does realize that China is very successful, and it's actually more successful by the day. The Chinese are really, they're building a great deal, they're investing, they're buying up gemstones every day. They're really on the move as a society right now. But this author believes that China is not a realistic threat to the West because the Chinese are really too conformist to be successful, according to this author. Now, as interesting as the view of this is, I don't know where this author lives, because the way the West is being overrun, I don't know how much longer the West can really sustain itself. So this author is a bit of a Pollyanna about the West. But nevertheless, this is really an excellent book because it really explains, I'm in a fairly brief or concise fashion, you know, it's not going to go on forever, about the way that genes are under selection, particularly in Eurasia, and it'll get into the nitty-gritties of that if you'd like. And it's quite blunt about the differences between societies. It's an overview. I mean, it's not exhaustive about every society. It doesn't go into Indian society very much, for example, which is a fairly complex society in some ways. I mean, South Asian Indians. But all in all, I would recommend this book as very worthwhile, and it's available on Kindle. So I hope you enjoyed my review, and thank you for listening. And hail victory. And I'll be back with dedication and leadership next time. Have a good night.
Okay, a while back somebody sent me a whole bunch of Third Reich music. Now, generally, I don't play too much of that on here because it's such great music that I really have a hard time aesthetically with those scratchy 80-year-old mono recordings off 78 RPM records. But these are better than most. Over the coming months here on Radio Free Northwest, I'm going to be playing regular audio clips from the late Edgar Steele, who was murdered in prison on September 4th of this year. Sorry, extrajudicially executed, to use the correct bureaucratic term. The dictatorship wanted Edgar Steele silenced, and it's very important to make sure that they fail and they understand that they have failed. Now, these sound clips, usually taken off Ed's old Conspiracy Pen Pal website, will be 7 to 10 years old and will often sound somewhat dated, but Ed's message is as timely and to the point nowadays as it always was.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's January 15, 2007, and today's article is entitled Marchin' Lootin' Killin' Day. Now, I've given it a lot of thought in view of all the negative articles concerning Martin Luther King Jr. Day that fly around the internet at this time of year, and I'm coming out in support of its status as a national holiday. In fact, I can't think of another holiday that better sums up all that America has come to represent. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, or as I like to think of it, Marchin' Lootin' Killin' Day, is the perfect reflection of modern America. So it deserves to be honored as the most perfect American holiday. Let's take a look at the top 10 reasons why this is so. Number 10, King's history and true behavior are kept secret from Americans, just like America's recent history and true behavior both domestically and abroad. In fact, the King cover-up is actually more legitimate because King's widow received a 1977 federal court order which sealed the huge FBI file on her husband for 50 years because its release would destroy his reputation. And we have another 20 years to go before that file is released. Reason number 9. King incited violence while preaching nonviolence, just as America does every time it invades another small, defenseless country. Wherever King went, violence erupted. He explained it himself in a piece he wrote for Saturday Review, April 3, 1965, in which he set forth the four steps of his technique. 1. Nonviolent demonstrators go into the streets to exercise their constitutional rights. 2. Racists resist by unleashing violence against them. 3. Americans of conscience, in the name of decency, demand federal intervention and legislation. 4. The administration, under mass pressure, initiates measures of immediate intervention and remedial legislation. Number 8. In the top 10 reasons why this should be honored as the most perfect American holiday, King ruthlessly stole from others, just like America steals Iraq's oil and uses inflation to steal from its own elderly and poor. The first public sermon that King ever gave in 1947 at the Ebenezer Baptist Church was plagiarized from a homily by Protestant clergyman Harry Emerson Fosdick entitled Life is What You Make It, according to the testimony of King's best friend of that time, Reverend Larry H. Williams. Now, for those who might not happen to know, plagiarism is a fancy word for theft. Literally means to steal. No less an authoritative source than the four senior editors of The Papers of Martin Luther King Jr., an official publication of the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change, Inc., whose staff includes King's widow, Coretta, stated of King's writings at both Boston University and Crozer Theological Seminary, judged retroactively by the standards of academic scholarship, his writings are tragically flawed by numerous instances of plagiarism. Appropriated passages are particularly evident in his writings in his major field of graduate study, systematic theology. only 49% of sentences in the section on tillage in his doctoral dissertation contain five or more words that were King's own. Close quote. Again, plagiarism. That's common theft, just like breaking into somebody's house and stealing their TV set. Only in this case, what you steal from somebody is the one thing they have to sell, their intellectual product. And Boston University officials eventually admitted, quote, there's no question but that Dr. King plagiarized in the dissertation, and they're the ones that gave him the doctorate. And even so, those same officials concluded, quote, no thought should be given to the revocation of Dr. King's doctoral degree because such action would serve no purpose. They were quoted in the New York Times edition of October 11, 1991. Now just think about how outrageous is the conduct of these unnamed Boston University officials. This would be like a judge letting a criminal defendant go free saying, while eyewitnesses proved that he stole the old lady's wheelchair and left her lying there on the subway tracks, no purpose would be served by punishing him or even making him give that wheelchair back to her. No purpose, my ass. Hell, you morons, King stole from another the only thing that other individual had by which to identify himself, his intellectual product. And you continue to let King pretend to be its author. In a court of law, you guys would be charged as accomplices after the fact and given the same sentence as the basic perp. What complete and utter slut and whores you so-called academics there at Boston University really are. King never was to outgrow his need to steal the intellectual work of others. For example, he lifted whole sections of his famous I Have a Dream speech from a sermon by 1950s black preacher Archibald Carey. Imagine that, if you will. The single thing for which King is most revered and remembered was stolen, yet he gets to keep it. Number 7 in the list of top 10 reasons why this should be a national holiday. King stole money from his followers and supporters, just like America steals money from its own people through confiscatory taxation, obscene monetary inflation, and outlandish deficit spending. According to Assistant FBI Director Sullivan, who had direct access to the surveillance files on King, which are denied the American people, King had embezzled or misapplied substantial amounts of money contributed to the civil rights movement. King used SCLC funds to pay for liquor and numerous prostitutes, both black and white, who were brought to his hotel rooms, often two at a time, for drunken sex parties, which sometimes lasted for several days. Number 6 on the list of top 10 reasons why this should be a national holiday. King used a phony name, just like modern America poses as the America born of the 1776 revolution. He was born Michael King, but his self-ordained preacher father changed his own name to Martin Luther King in 1935, thereby grandiosely presuming to wrap himself in the legend of the great Protestant reformer Martin Luther. Thus, his son became Martin Luther King Jr., of course. Number 5 on the list, King lied prodigiously, just as America lies chronically about all things domestic and foreign. Now, quite aside from all the plagiarism noted up to here, each and every instance of which is a lie, FBI director at the time, J. Edgar Hoover, named Martin Luther King Jr. as the single most notorious liar in the country. Number 4 on the list of reasons why this is the ultimate American holiday. King liked white hookers, similar to how America actively now couples its white daughters with blacks of every stripe. King spent his last night on earth in an adulterous liaison with a white prostitute, just one in a long string of such assignations. And that is from a book entitled And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, a biography of King by the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, published in 1989. Number 3. King liked brutalizing weaker people, for which America has shown a predilection in both Iraq and Afghanistan, most recently. During his last night alive, King was witnessed beating the prostitute he procured for the evening. This, too, is from the Reverend Abernathy's book just noted. Number two on the list, King was a communist, just like America's government has become. According to King's biographer and sympathizer, David Garrow, King privately described himself as a Marxist. In his 1981 book, The FBI and Martin Luther King Jr., Garrow quotes King as saying in SCLC staff meetings, "We have moved into a new era, which must be an era of revolution. The whole structure of American life must be changed. We are engaged in the class struggle." None other than Bobby Kennedy, U.S. Attorney General at the time, had King's office and hotel rooms bugged during the mid-1960s, developing extensive evidence of King's communist affiliations, revealing his communist financing, and disclosing his handlers. This is how the shocking discovery of his sexual perversions was made. Jewish communist Stanley Levison can best be described as King's behind-the-scenes handler. Levison, who had for years been in charge of the secret funneling of Soviet funds to the Communist Party USA, was King's mentor and was actually the brains behind many of King's more successful ploys. It was Levison who edited King's book, Stride Toward Freedom. It was Levison who arranged for a publisher. Levison even prepared King's income tax returns. It was Levison who really controlled the fundraising and agitation activities of the SCLC. Levison wrote many of King's speeches. King described Levison as one of his closest friends. And finally, the number one reason why Martin Luther King Jr. Day is the perfect reflection of America. Martin Luther King Jr., like other black leaders, was run by Jews, just as America's government, banking, and media are run today. Jewish communist Stanley Levison can best be described as King's behind-the-scenes handler. It was Levison who really controlled the fundraising and agitation activities of the SCLC. And Levison, of course, was Jewish, not to mention a communist. But I repeat myself. Only in recent years has the NAACP had a black president. Previously, its leadership always was Jewish. The same people who created that organization in the first place. Upon further reflection, I realize that Christmas, too, is a national holiday which honors but a single individual. However, Christmas now has been stripped bare of both its ancient pagan and modern Christian meanings by American Zionists and their Shabbos Goyim, the American Christian fundamentalist dispensationalist rapture bunnies, such that it has become merely a major shopping opportunity. But that makes it yet another perfect reflection of modern America, doesn't it? How fitting that the only so-called religious holidays left to Americans at the end of the year are one recently created for self-profit by a black American ex-convict, Kwanzaa, of course, and another that celebrates the massacre of others by Jews, Hanukkah. We should not honor such a misbegotten individual as Michael King Jr., nor should we honor the non-existent ideals that King supposedly has come to represent. Equal opportunity, brotherhood, and overcoming prejudice. Instead, we should take the opportunity to recognize all that black America actually has come to represent to America. Advanced placement of the undeserving, hobbling those who excel to create a false image of equality, welfare entitlement mentality, spite and resentment on all sides, images of post-Katrina looting, whining, and rampant lawlessness come to mind, demanding, always demanding that which they have not, will not, and cannot earn for themselves, forever whining about non-existent racial discrimination, Justice Department figures of overwhelming black-on-white crime far beyond whatever could be explained by differing social or economic circumstance also come to mind. If this must be MLK Day, then let those initials stand for what they truly have become in an increasingly racially divided and tense America. Marching, looting, and killing. Yep, marching, looting, killing day. Let the word go forth from this day forward that no longer will we recognize the monster that Michael King Jr. became, and instead will let this day forever stand for what Black America has come to represent, what Black America does best. Marching, looting, killing day. I came of age just as America began its long, agonizing conversion into the dreadful creature that now strides back and forth across the globe, demanding, threatening, killing, maiming, taking, and sermonizing to all in the process. Most of us still are unable to define the problem, but at least now we all know that a serious problem has evolved. Vietnam still was but a vague cloud on a distant horizon. Our parents told us that we could be better than they, and we believed them. We invented drugs, sex, and rock and roll. Some of us marched for Black civil rights, at once naively and guiltily believing what we were told by college professors about social disadvantage, economic handicap, and how we are all the same under the skin, how we all bleed red. We forgot that every beast in the forest also bleeds red. We had no idea that we were about to trade places with the Black man in America. Our icons of liberalism and compassion in those days, Hubert Humphrey and Ted Kennedy, assured us that the changes they introduced with their new immigration reform bills would improve America. Desperate to recapture the dreams of Camelot dashed with the loss of JFK, we had no idea that a tidal wave of unchecked immigration, composed of a hostile and aggressive people with no intention of assimilating, was about to sweep over America, forever changing her landscape. We ignored rumors of conspiracy and one thing and another. We denied the evidence of our own eyes. We marched unaware into the maw of political correctness and proceeded to offer up our children upon its altar. Today, they serve in the priesthood of the horrible beast that has risen up and assumed control of all of America. We never suspected that when finally we were handed the keys to the executive washroom, the world we were promised had been traded in for the very thing against which our parents thought they had fought in World Wars I and II. We easily could have stopped them in the 60s, but we had no idea of our power. We could have voted them out in the 70s, but we vainly hoped for better times after our long journey into the nightmare that Vietnam became. We could have pulled them from power and had them tried and convicted during the 90s, but simple greed got the better of us. Now, as we approach our dotage, many of us realize what we have and have not done. We are tired, many of us say. That is but another excuse for not doing what we should have done so long ago. If not now, when? If not us, who? The time, at long last, has come. Our time, my friends. Because of our sloth, it'll be a long, bitter, and painful ordeal. We have nobody to blame but ourselves for waiting this long. But we will do it, because it must be done. And always, our forebears have done what must be done. Their blood flows in our veins today, as it does in our children. That is how I know we ultimately will prevail. We always have. We always will. We have left ourselves no other choice. New America. An idea whose time has come. My name is Edgar J. Steele. Thanks for listening.
This is the Pine Creek String Band. Thank you. Okay, now a few logistic comments about the show itself. Now this week we've had all kinds of outside submissions of audio files that people want me to play on here, including Andy's latest episode of Real Politics, several pieces from The Trucker, and the first audio file I've gotten from Germany from one of our comrades over there, and which I haven't even had time to listen to yet. Now this week we actually had enough outside audio to fill up the whole show if I'd wanted to do that. However, the rest of our comrades are going to have to wait until next week so that I can fill up the rest of this week's show with the sound of my own voice, because when I don't do that, when there are too many guest voices on here in a show, I get emails accusing me of phoning it in and being lazy and just slapping the show together and being a con man and all that crap. Now, I know the Edgar Steele piece this week was really long, but I had to get that on by way of striking while the iron is hot. The Northwest Nation has another martyr now, a man who was murdered by the dictatorship in order to make him fall silent, and we have to make sure that they fail. Now, I won't be playing those long Edgar Steele pieces on every show, and I may try some variations on the theme, like reading from Steele's book, Defensive Racism. But from now on, Edgar Steele is going to be a regular part of our podcasts, as his life and his work are quietly melded into the whole Northwest Front ideological matrix, so to speak. Now, eventually Steele will go down in history as one of the fathers of our new country. But I'm already running long now. Now, what exactly do I mean when I say that? I always have to keep these shows under 1 hour and 20 minutes. Now, that's the length of a commercially available blank CD that can be used to copy the show off the internet when you download the file. Now, even though only one of you out there is still doing the CDs that I asked you guys to make for me a year ago, everyone else having gotten bored and wandered away from it, I still need to keep it below an hour and 20 minutes per show. Now, this is not just so that hopefully some of you will start making CD copies of Radio Free Northwest again, but also owing to the short American attention span, which is hard enough to get to concentrate on anything for a little over an hour every week. Yeah, I know that doesn't sound very nice, and now I'm going to get emails telling me all about how I need to stroke your egos and make you feel good about yourselves, and I can catch more flies with honey than with vinegar, to which I will send my usual reply that I'm not trying to catch flies, I'm trying to change the world. But what can I tell you? The short attention span of American white people is a very significant obstacle to our moving forward. It is real, and it is something that I have to take into account every day. It's just the reality that I and all white nationalists have to deal with. White Americans are capable of being intensely interested in anything for 15 minutes. They've been socially and mentally engineered that way through a lifetime of sound bites and 30-second commercials on TV and half-hour sitcoms that consist of 21 minutes of actual content broken up into segments of about 6 minutes between commercials, etc., etc. I'm sure we're all familiar with the image of the white couch potato who sits on the sofa staring at a big-screen TV with the remote in his hand, flicking and flicking the channels, all 312 of them, or however many his cable package has, not really watching anything, just stimulating his brain with repeatedly changing streams of electrons, or however images are conveyed by video screens. That's basically how most surfing the internet works, constantly clicking the mouse in search of new images. Now, we've come to learn over the last generation that electronic stimulation from moving video screens on a television or a computer can be just as much an addiction as crack cocaine or Jack Daniels. The electronic screen is literally mesmerizing us and draining away our intellectual capacity to think, like some alien monster with brain-sucking tentacles in a Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode. Our minds are literally being softened into goo so that they can serve as receptacles for whatever the Jews want to pour into them. I have to get to those minds first somehow, which is hard when only a few thousand people seem to even know that we exist. Now, whether I like it or not, I have to adapt to this reality. I really wish that my novels were all that I needed to communicate with you guys, that we were back in the old days of 100 or 50 or hell, even 30 years ago, when we would all sit down and read big, thick books in order to get forbidden and subversive racial knowledge. But it's interesting that what I've been getting a lot of over the past 18 months or so since Freedom Sons was published is requests for stuff like PDF files, ebooks, CDs, and whatnot, with me reading chapters out loud from the Northwest novels, etc., etc. Anything so you don't actually have to summon the mental muscle to sit down, hold a book in your hand, and concentrate on reading a printed page for content without illustrations. In other words, read a big block of text and actually think about what you just read means. Now, that's how ideas were conveyed among our people and among Western nations since the time of Johannes Gutenberg back in the 1400s, but no more. Now, my generation was taught how to do that. We were probably the last generation that was taught how to do that. In public schools, no less. But anyone born since about 1972 or so is going to have problems absent an electronic screen with something moving on it, the dancing baby or whatever. Actually, you know, the dancing baby is probably outdated now. I keep having to remember that there are some of you guys who don't even remember the 90s, for God's sake. White Americans see new stimulus that they like, and then they lose interest and they wander away in search of more entertainment, more stimulation for their bored and jaded brains. We're kind of like hummingbirds who have to suck 20 times our own weight in flower nectar every day in order to survive. It's like white people's minds and their personalities are genuinely hungry, starving for true purpose and long-term spiritual sustenance of the kind that used to be supplied by religious faith or patriotism or commerce and economic adventure or exploring a new continent or creating works of art, basically all the things that white people do. But we don't recognize that sustenance when we see it, absent the bells and whistles and styrofoam packaging that Americans have come to expect. Now, this is what's driving me up the goddamn wall. The fact that we have the answer. Guys, we are sitting on a treasure chest with the most valuable treasure in history. The truth, the plan that will secure the existence of our people in the future for white children. We've got it, but we just can't get anybody interested because nobody knows that we are here. I simply cannot persuade enough of you to post, to not just listen to this podcast, but to hit that send key multiple times all over the internet and bring white people to northwestfront.org. Now, part of this is a deliberate blackout. Sure, there was Rachel Maddow's sudden shutdown in 2011 after 2 days, and that was a dead giveaway. And there was the internet cleanse, or whatever it's called, that was performed back in August of last year that removed most of the party's outside links from the internet. Now, there's no question that the party is being deliberately blacklisted by various enemy whatevers, NGOs, ADL, Mossad, whoever's doing this. But it's not all some big Jew conspiracy to keep us down. And we really could break it if we tried. The problem with the net, which is the one medium of mass communication that we have access to, and that's why we have to use it, whether we like it or not. Anyway, the problem with the internet is that there's just so much of it. I read this week, it's now official. There are now over 1 billion websites on the internet. We have less than a dozen of those sites. I'm going to keep after all of you to post like fiends and get our link out there, but realistically, unless and until there is some kind of change in our immediate situation on the ground here, which generates system media publicity, our growth is simply going to be too slow to do any good. I've been telling you the truth. We are growing, but it's just not fast enough. Now, if any of you have any ideas as to how we can generate establishment media publicity without anybody dying or going to prison, by all means, lay it on me. Now, that seems to be the main proviso. We get no media publicity at all unless somebody bleeds to death in the street or unless one of us, preferably tattooed, can be shown in an orange jumpsuit and shackles. Seriously, guys, any ideas that do not involve 6 or 7 of us running around in public and waving signs and making ourselves look weak and foolish? We tried that. Been trying it for 50 years. It doesn't work. Now, I'm all ears because somehow or other, we have to break this blackout. This is Casey Chambers.
Small. born. Sun don't shine no more. Late one night, sorrow come round, scratching at my door. But I cut my hands and break my back, dragging this bag of stones till they bury me down beneath the ground with the dust and rattle.
Comment. Back a few weeks ago when we were talking about aliens on the show, I got one or two responses to the effect that if I wanted to get people to start responding to the NF message and moving to the Northwest, I needed to turn the whole party into a UFO cult wherein we would be the servants of the Greys who were fighting against the Jews, the reptilian people who were left behind by the serpent gods, and we could use Bill White's work as sacred texts and so on. No, I'm not going to do that, but I kind of get what these people mean. I have noticed that for psychological reasons I kind of touched on earlier, white people will do things for weirded out cult gurus that they simply will not do just because it's right, or for the sake of the 14 words, or even to give their own children a future. White people will do for weird, strange, demented reasons things that they will not do for cool, calm, rational reasons based in their own self-interests. We're genuinely self-destructive that way. Now, 150 years ago, the Mormons did basically what I'm asking you people to do. They came across the prairies and the plains, and they created Utah as a separate nation called Deseret. It's true that after the buccaneer capitalists of the 1890s spread some bread of heaven around in Salt Lake City and showed their prophet of the time which side of his bread was buttered, he managed to get a convenient revelation or two from God about knocking off the polygamy and so forth. But politically expedient revelations are nothing new, and the fact is that the Mormon society which Brigham Young founded is still more or less there. Back in the 1980s, the effing Bhagwan Rajneesh was able to get thousands of white people to move to the Dalles, Oregon, and they got onto the voting rolls and almost took over the town until his white harem women started poisoning one another and hiring hitmen to kill one another. Now, the Scientologists have pretty much done the same thing in Clearwater, Florida. I understand that down through the years, both Democrats and Republicans have actually had to gerrymander and re-gerrymander that whole district, or else there would now be Scientologists in the Florida State Legislature and Congress. And although Starship Ruthie Norman has been dead for over 20 years, there are supposedly still some of those unarius loons hiding in tunnels out in Montana, living on MREs and bottled water and waiting for the mothership to descend and take us all away to a galaxy far, far away or whatever. I'm sorry, even after all these many years, I don't get it. I cannot understand why I can't persuade you people to do, because it is right, what tens of thousands of white people have done within living memory for strange, weirded out, non-white, or just plain deranged cult leaders. I wish in a way I was a cult leader, that I was dishonest, and that I told you whatever you wanted to hear in order to get you to respond with money and with your moving vans. Maybe I should throw in some aliens or suddenly discover a fourth book of the Bible like Joseph Smith or whatever. No, don't worry, I'm not going to do that. But Jesus, sometimes I'm tempted. White people simply don't respond to rational persuasion, which is odd in view of the fact that we're the smartest people on the planet. Who knows, maybe it's time we gave the irrational a try. But for now, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.